Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Speaking of the order of service, there was an ongoing conversation in one of the congregations I led in Massachusetts about whether the offering should be taken before the sermon or after the sermon. Before the sermon was an act of faith. After the sermon was a judgment. Knowing Massachusetts Unitarian Universalists, half the congregation insisted on one way and the other half insisted on the other way. Those who remember radio, in the days when one could hear songs with comprehensible and civil lyrics and stories that made you laugh or shiver, you may remember the opening words of this radio series. Who knows what evil lurks in the minds of men? The shadow knows. Well, how did the shadow know about the evil in men's hearts? Well, he would watch them when they couldn't see him. The shadow was invisible. Years ago in the Orient, the announcer began each week and went on to explain how the wealthy playboy Lamont Cranston had gone to the Orient and there had discovered the power to cloud the minds of people so that he was invisible to them. The shadow was able to know the truth of people by seeing them when they thought they could not be seen. It's an enduring fantasy, long celebrated in story and myth. H.G. Wells wrote a novel called The Invisible Man, several times made into scary movies. One of the oldest starring, I think, was Claude Rains, an actor some of you may remember. Ruminations on the intriguing possibilities of invisibility goes back literally through the millennia to Plato in The Republic. In book two of The Republic, which I'm sure you've read, Glaucon, the older brother of Plato and the frequent foil of Socrates, argues with Socrates about justice and the good. Glaucon believed that people are not naturally good and moral, that justice and morality are not inherent in people. Glaucon, in order to illustrate his point, tells the story of Gyges. And I'm sure you were wondering what on earth Gyges was when you saw that. Well, Gyges is part of the story to illustrate the argument that we only act morally because we do not have the power to act otherwise. Our fear of getting caught, he insisted, our fear of being punished is all that keeps us honest and moral and ethical. Without the fear of consequence or punishment, so-called just and so-called unjust people will both act similarly, that is, unjustly and immorally. Dawkins' story lesson is the man Gyges worked as a shepherd for the king of Lydia. One day a storm and an earthquake opened up the ground where his flock were feeding. Amazed, Gyges climbed down into the chasm. Inside he saw a bronze horse with doors in its flanks. He peered in through the doors and saw that the horse was actually a tomb. Inside the tomb was the body of somebody, obviously of high stature and wearing only a ring. Well, Gyges pulled the ring from the body and climbed back into his field. Sometimes later, the shepherds gathered to make a regular report to the king about the state of his sheep. As Gyges sat and talked, he toyed with his ring, as some of us sometimes do. As he turned the collet of the ring in his palm, he began to realize that the others in his shepherd's circle were talking as if he was not there. He had become invisible. Amazed, he touched the ring again, turned it the other way, and reappeared. Repeating this gave the same result. Gone, come back, gone, come back. Turning the ring one way, he disappeared. Turning it the other way, he reappeared. And recognizing the boundless possibilities of this wonder, Gyges manages to get himself appointed as representative of the shepherds to the court of the king of Lydia. Now, while at the court, making use of his magic ring, he seduces the queen, enlists her support, and by being invisible, he is easily able to kill the king and rule in his stead. Eventually, since in Greek philosophic thought, shepherds do not actually become kings, eventually Gyges comes to a bad end. Caught in his visible mode, he is killed by an enemy. Having told the story of how invisibility would corrupt, because it would allow people to behave as they wished without fear of consequence, Glaucon asks Socrates to imagine that there are two rings, one in the hands of a just person, the other in the hands of an unjust person. The just person, of course, would intend to remain just. The just and moral person we would like to think, Socrates liked to think, would not exploit the ring, but would use it only for good. But no. Glaucon insists that self-interest and hedonistic impulses would prevail. The just person would simply not be able to resist exploiting the advantage of invisibility by acquiring whatever he or she wanted in complete safety. Invading the space of others unaware indulging anonymously in the pleasures of the flesh, punishing enemies with iniquity, or rewarding friends and sycophants. The user of the ring of Jairus would be untouchable, would be godlike. The just and the unjust would be virtually indistinguishable. And thus individual morality, Glaucon proudly proclaimed, is determined not by conscious will, but by necessity. If self-indulgence can be sated without fear of discovery or consequence, then the propensity for being unjust, because it is profitable, would be demonstrable and will prevail. Glaucon went so far as to argue that anyone with such power as Glaucon's ring, who never took advantage of it for personal gain, would be considered by others to be a total idiot. And so Plato wonders if, in his Republic, he wonders if there is any person so just and so moral that they would not take advantage of such a magic ring. So Socrates searches for an honest man, one just and incorruptible person. But take away the threat of consequence, and where would such a person be found? There are numerous pictures of a robed man wandering in the dark with a lantern, looking for an honest man. Well, it occurs to me that perhaps we make myths out of human beings, Christs, Buddhas, holy and incorruptible leaders, because we do so want to believe that purity of heart is a human possibility. And so we are so crushed when our idols behave as if they would not be found out, as if they were invisible. When someone goes astray in high places, we say, how stupid could he have been? Did he think he was invisible? We want to believe that safe in the robing room, safe in the boardroom, the motel room, the mayor's office, the Oval Office, out of the public eye, invisible, our heroes would remain saintly, the morally superhuman human beings we want them to be for our own sake. Shoeless Joe Jackson, baseball's one-time hero, is discovered being in on the fixed games. And as he left the field in disgrace, there was a boy, the hero worshiper, plaintively crying, say it ain't so, Joe, say it ain't so. Surely every misdeed, every immoral act, every unjust act is done under the guise of presumed invisibility. That is, under the assumption that one cannot be seen and therefore will not be punished. Well, let us not throw stones. We all live in glass houses. Let us, in fairness to our heroes, if not in exoneration of them, let us judge ourselves before we judge those others. There I am in a Starbucks coffee shop. I really like Starbucks coffee shops. With the coffee bought and fixed just the way I like it. I the reading opportunities in the Starbucks shop. And there in a rack is a neatly stacked pile of the day's New York Times. I really like the New York Times, but I'm not going to spend $2 for it. And beside the enticing rack of fresh-smelling Times is a basket filled with bits and pieces of inferior papers, sports pages, business pages, car sales pages. And I glance around. One server has just taken out the trash. The other has just slipped out back to get something. I am invisible. And there is the unguarded, the helpless New York Times. Do I slip one off the rack and tuck it under my arm, thus saving the outrageous cost? No, I do not. To your relief, I tell you, I do not steal the New York Times. Because, as you no doubt believe of this preacher, I am pure and without corruption. I am idiotically honest to the core. So what do I tell myself? What do I tell myself? I say to myself that I would like to grab one of those New York Times, but they're not free. They are for sale. And if I were to take one without paying for it, that would be stealing. And as one president said, I am not a thief. Well, no. That's not really what runs through my mind or even jostles my moral compass. No one was watching in those critical moments of moral anxious. Or was someone watching? What about security cameras? In millibits of seconds, my impulse control mechanism is whirring away and coming to the usual conclusion that I am probably not invisible. I would probably be caught. I don't believe in invisibility. Therefore, I do not steal. Therefore, I am not a thief. You may insist that even if you were absolutely sure that you could not be observed, virtually invisible, you would do nothing immoral or unjust or illegal, not so much as sneaking past a stop sign on an empty road in the dead of night. Well, if so, you have my undying admiration. Over here, Socrates, your search is over. So let's look at our society among the not so virtuous who believe themselves to be, and perhaps through our lack of vigilance or uncaring, they might as well be invisible. They sell drugs to children. They sell powerful weapons to anyone who will pay for them. They profit from the labor and the short lives of thousands, millions of the world's children, of prisoners, of the poor. They make the air unbreathable. They poison the water, destroy the forests, pave over the fields, and level the forests. They control the flow of information so that the interests of the few appear to be the demands of the many. beloved exemplars, sexually abuse those who trust them. Clayton Mogridge writes, "We read that Kodak or First National Bank is laying off a few thousand workers, or the Corrections Corporation of America, backed by money from Kentucky Fried Chicken, is running prisons in Texas. But the individuals who make those decisions are unnamed and unseen. The real people who make the decisions in our society own the ring of Gyges. They are unseen. They are free to act invisibly, and they therefore can act unjustly and immorally." As Mogridge writes, perhaps it is true that almost no one could resist using the ring of Gyges to rip people off. Perhaps the right thing to do on finding it would be to destroy it. Given what we know today of the modern corporation, the time has come to destroy it, or at least to break its power, to provide anonymity to its power holders. It could be that such a time has come, the popular and the powerful, some of them, too few of them, have indeed been seen and suffer the consequences of being seen. They acted behind a cloak of invisibility, and suddenly it was as if, just as they were about to deftly lift a copy of the New York Times, they were fixed in a spotlight. Sirens blared, and the Valkyries came in for the kill. Well, perhaps we have outlived the time in which people like my grandparents, though they never saw them, believed that Ford and Carnegie and the others were at heart good men who cared about them and their families. Even while they fainted on the assembly land, choked on the soot and the smoke, and swallowed the blood from the beatings of hired union-busting thugs. Those gangster tycoons were virtually invisible. Evil must be seen to be believed. Recall that. Evil must be seen to be believed. A generation ago, oh good Lord, was it a generation ago, as the goons in Chicago beat the demonstrators back, and there in Selma and elsewhere we linked arms and chanted together, "The whole world is watching, the whole world is watching." Those who peer fearfully into the darkness, those who desire justice for all people, must continue to light the night fires. And those who desire freedom and safety for all must stay awake and watchful. Sleep with one eye open. Thomas Jefferson, paraphrasing an Irish judge, said, "The price of freedom is eternal vigilance." Perhaps the English novelist Arnold Bennett put it more directly. He said, "The price of freedom is eternal publicity." As for me and my self-revelation that my sense of justice and morality, more often than not, has more to do with the fear of being caught than with the inherent purity of heart. What am I to make of that? What am I to make of myself? Well, for one thing, I don't think I ever thought otherwise. From the very first time as a child, I could swipe a shilling out of the jar of shillings reserved for the light meter and turned it into licorice sticks at the candy store. Then and always there, I have known that if I am not the embodiment of the heart of darkness, I am unmistakably and inescapably human. As the Apostle Paul said, the evil that I would do, I do not. But the good that I would do, I do not. What is important in all this for us people of liberal faith is the recognition of our human limitations, even proudly denying that we are saved. Some of our fundamentalist brothers and sisters believe that they are not only saved, but justified and sanctified, meaning they cannot sin. They must think themselves invisible, even to God. There's something else I'm clear about. While I recognize that for the most part, as Glaucon insisted to Socrates, when I am good, it is because I dare not be. It is also true, as Plato himself believed, that I am at times good, honest, even courageous, because I know and experience myself to be part of the same stuff of most of humanity. The teacher said, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." There's nothing in there about inherent goodness. It was a commandment. It was just do it. When I was a Methodist boy minister, I and my brother ministers, not a sister minister in sight in those days, I and my brother ministers pledged that as our founder John Wesley ordered, we would strive toward perfection. I was relieved to later discover that the teaching of the Buddha, who said that we should give up all striving. Now there is my man. I was also relieved to discover the Universalists, who said that we were all good enough for God to love. And the Unitarians, who said we need to think less about sin and move about improving the lot of humankind. They also thought they were too good for God to not love them. And so I came to accept the position that if we could become invisible, we would most likely seduce the queen and kill the king, or vice versa. Symbolically, at least, I mean only that I came to accept that my motivations in being good or not so good are at the very least complicated. That's not much of a religious lesson, nor is it, I suppose, enormously inspiring. But the message that comes down to us from ancient philosophers, the wise teachers, even from the shadow, is that all wishful thinking and idealism aside, we cannot depend on anything like essential goodness, either in ourselves or in them. This ought not to be disheartening It is simply what we have always suspected. We are therefore called to be keepers of the light. We need each other's light to hold us to the good. This little light of mine, long may it shine. Amen.